Raycash, a community advocate and law student on unceded Algonquin territory at the University of Ottawa.
My name is Kim Pate, and I have the privilege and responsibility of being a senator in unceded, unsurrendered Algonquin Anishinaabeg territory.
And you're listening to Appointed. So, Kim, we're recording from our respective homes in the middle of a coronavirus outbreak. And I'm wondering, how are you managing? I know the Senate is back in session, and I think maybe our listeners might be interested in what that looks like and what measures the Senate is taking to help keep people safe while still being able to advocate and do what you guys do best.
Well, we just sat on Saturday, April 11th, to pass the second set of emergency provisions. We still have huge gaps, and as many of us pointed out in our comments during the Senate hearing, or Senate proceedings, that there are still far too many people who are not covered yet by the economic provisions. You know, people are talking about this pandemic and the COVID-19 virus as the great equalizer that applies equally to everybody. And a number of us are trying to point out that's just not true, that we all may be equally capable of catching it, but that's determined on how we're able to manage and administer and implement the health and hygiene recommendations, the physical distancing, the washing your hands, the disinfecting that's required in order to help keep this virus at bay. If you're homeless, if you're precariously employed, whose immigration status is not secure, and all of those individuals, as well as those in institutions like prisons and long-term care homes and psychiatric hospitals, are all particularly vulnerable. And so what it's actually exposing is inequality and the intersections of those inequalities and the multiplier effect that has on who actually is most vulnerable to not just contracting COVID-19, but dying from it. And the impact on that globally, we're seeing in jurisdictions or in countries where people have not taken seriously the inequality issues, and where even in Canada, we've let our social safety net be rent with holes and eviscerated over the years, that there are far too many people who have fallen through not just the cracks, but the huge rents. And so it's not much of a safety net for some people. And so we really need to be rebuilding it in an urgent way right now, but with the long-term interests of folks in mind.
Yeah, and I think talking about folks who are more likely to be affected really makes me think of places like Louisiana and Chicago, where it's slightly more than 70% of the coronavirus deaths are Black folk, African American people. And that points to some of the disparities that we have known exist between healthcare that's provided for Black people as opposed to the rest of the population. And that conversation is similar in Canada and also extends to Indigenous folk in Canada. There's also ongoing challenges with the state cracking down on policing and ticketing, and that sort of activity is more likely to affect homeless folk and Black people and people who are more often criminalized in our society. And so I think when we talk about the coronavirus being the great equalizer, I think it's the opposite. I think it really highlights so many of the inequalities that we see in our society.
Absolutely. I was standing in line with a man who was exhibiting behavior that, you know, would often be described as mental health issues this past week. And people kept yelling at him to move away, that he was too close. And he looked at me and he says, "What do they mean?" I said, "Well, we're supposed to stand, you know, 2 meters apart." And he looked at me and I said, "You know, like the length of a hockey stick." And he goes, "You think it's that bad?" And I said, "Well, the doctors and healthcare professionals are saying it is, that we have to stand, be that far apart." And he just says, excuse my language, he says, "Fuck, if it's that bad, we're all dead." And I thought, truer words haven't been spoken. But if that man is one of the ones who's being ticketed, he doesn't have a full appreciation. He doesn't have a computer. He's not watching. He doesn't have a cell phone. He's not paying attention to the news because he doesn't have the means to. And so
here, you know, as I'm, you know, everybody else is yelling at him, and as I'm trying to explain it, he's realizing, you know, in the situation that I'm presuming he may live in, I could be completely wrong, but the opportunity to be that distant from people may not even exist when he's trying mm-hmm. to have shelter at night or from the rain. And so it struck me that, yeah, the idea that we could actually police our way out of this is just underscores the lack of awareness of some of us who may have greater privilege to understand just how precarious life can be for those who are not just in those situations before this pandemic, but now are struggling. And if those folks are getting $1,000 tickets and being threatened with jail, we know that it will likely just increase the risk, the public health and the safety risk to all of us.
Absolutely. I mean, when folks are being policed in an increased way, they're more likely to contract the virus because we're violating social distancing by, you know, you walking over and giving me a ticket or questioning me or putting me in handcuffs. And it makes no sense to be giving tickets to people who maybe lost their job or there's one less income in their family space, giving on top of that folks another $1,000, $9,000 ticket is completely unreasonable. So yeah, I think that our governments need to be considerate about the ways in which the virus is dealt with and how we try to encourage people to social distance without placing people in more danger. And continuing on this thread, we're talking about folks who are at higher risk. And we know that the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights was warning governments not to forget about those behind bars and warning that COVID-19 has begun to strike in prisons. And we've seen that sort of lay out after the High Commissioner warned about it. It's important for governments to start to reduce that number of people who are in detention. And do you think that Canada has done that in an effective way? What do you think needs to be done additionally?
Canada has not, as a federal jurisdiction. There are patchworks happening across the country. Ironically, Ontario was one of the first to act to announce that nobody would be serving their intermittent sentences and that they would start to use temporary absence programs. Judges started to issue orders to enhance the bail process rather than use the remand centers and jail people awaiting trial. As well, we saw that in Nova Scotia, one of my former classmates, who's the chief judge there, was holding bail hearings on weekends to try and process as many of the cases so that individuals were not going to be remanded in custody or they could review bail. So different things have been happening across the country, but the part of the challenge is it is a patchwork. There hasn't been a concerted effort between provincial, territorial, and federal authorities to actually reduce the numbers and allow the kinds of physical distancing that the health authorities are all calling for. And at the federal level, there's basically the attitude has been to essentially lock down institutions and use isolation. Nobody is asking what's happening in our structured intervention units, in part because almost every prison is now completely being treated as though they're segregation units or structured intervention units. And so we have huge issues around the spread that's already happening. Huge issues, as Dr. Orkin told us, about the fact that we may be seeing it exponentially increasing, and because testing isn't keeping up, we may not know actually what the numbers are. And I was horrified when he said that the indication that 20% of those that are testing are coming back as positive, it means that it's probably to a factor of 10, the numbers that are actually in the prisons. And we've seen this in other situations when in New Orleans, you mentioned Louisiana, when Hurricane Katrina hit, whole prisons were just locked down. And we don't know to this day what exactly happened to all those folks who were inside. But we certainly know they weren't released. And we certainly know that there were huge physical life consequences for folks who were locked up at that time and that many died. And so we need to be concerned about, for all of us, why we're not actually looking at reducing those numbers and allowing the kinds of public health measures we're being encouraged to take outside of institutions to happen inside institutions.
Yeah, I think you touched on one of our incredible guests that we will be speaking to. We spoke with Dr. Aaron Orkin, and you did the interview, so great job. And he's a physician, epidemiologist, and assistant professor at the University of Toronto. And we also had the incredible opportunity of speaking with Robin Maynard. She's an activist, and she wrote the best-selling book, Policing Black Lives. So we'll have a link to her book there in the show notes for folks who haven't had a chance to read it. And then last but certainly not least, we had the opportunity to speak with Louise Arbour. We've had some incredible people that we spoke with and featured on this episode, and I really hope that you folks learn a lot from these interviews, and we'll be wrapping up with some final thoughts after we hear from them. So without further ado, I think we'll start with those interviews.
Good morning. I'm joined this morning by Dr. Aaron Orkin, who's a physician as well as an epidemiologist and works at the University of Toronto. Aaron, the first thing I had to do was look up what is an epidemiologist. Perhaps you could explain for our listeners.
Thanks for having me here. Thanks for asking. Yeah. An epidemiologist is somebody who studies epidemics. And epidemics broadly are not just things like COVID or infectious diseases. They're the distribution of diseases within communities and populations. So you can have an epidemic of heart disease, you can have an epidemic of obesity, and you can have an epidemic of COVID. So it's the questions of how diseases are distributed within communities and some of the things that follow from that, like what strategies can be taken to prevent and control conditions as they spread within communities. In a way, it's a little bit about thinking about the difference between an individual health problem and a population health problem. We're thinking about our society and communities as ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. And I have to ask, what made you interested in this area and how did you end up working in this particular area of medicine?
So I'm also an emergency physician, so I really do love looking after individual patients and caring for individual patients within the context of that relationship that makes medical care so powerful and valuable. But what I really experienced through my training is the observation that there are many sorts of conditions, and our present situation really highlights this as well, that cannot be managed by treating individuals. They are a function of the environment that we live in. They're a function of the relationship between people and between communities, and that really effective strategies to address those problems can only be done at the community level. And there are obvious examples of that and less obvious ones. So we all know that our health is transformed by the fact that we have clean drinking water and food supply, so much so that we often take that for granted. In other conditions, like the outbreak we're facing right now, that's much, much more obvious that the way we behave as communities around things like social distancing have transformative effects for the whole community, far more so than any individual action. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing fascinated me, which is why I started studying population medicine and epidemiology.
Okay. And just before we started this call, I was reading some information about the disproportionate impact the pandemic is having. And as we know, on March 11th, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, and was reading about the disproportionate impact it's having in communities of color, racialized communities, vulnerable communities such as those who are homeless, those in prison. And I'm curious, I know it's an area that you've also been concerned about, and why, as an epidemiologist, are you concerned about what's happening in our prisons, and why should the public be concerned?
Right. So when I say that epidemiologists and population medicine specialists study the distribution of disease, that goes very quickly and hand in hand with an interest in health equity. when we say distribution, one cannot study those sorts of things within our society without noticing that marginalized populations bear the brunt of almost every type of disease, more so than those of means. And that incorporates all sorts of different inequities. So you mentioned people of color. It can also incorporate issues of poverty, geography, access to services. And in the context of an epidemic like COVID, where distance and social distancing is such a crucial part of our response, not only for the individuals involved, but for our whole society, any place where people live in a congregate setting and live really close to one another with a really limited ability to distance themselves from one another to maintain not only individual hygiene, but social distancing becomes a threat not only for them, but a threat for our entire community. And this is the crux of the issue. We've all been, I think, quite steeped in the last couple of weeks in this concept of flattening the curve. And what that means is an effort to keep the number of cases that we are managing in any critical way requiring ICU beds or hospital admission below the maximum capacity of our hospitals and our ICUs. And when we have environments where certain groups of people are unable to control the spread of infection, that becomes a space where we're going to have more infections, more hospitalizations, more ICU admissions, and that affects everybody. So I've become committed to understanding and exploring how we can improve social distancing in congregate living centers, not only because it's important to the health of the people who live there, but because it's important to everyone's health. Never before have some of the needs of people living in specific and often underserved settings been more crucial to the health of our entire society rather than just a question of the health of the people who live there. And that's where this issue of people living in correctional facilities come in. There's lots of work in public health, population medicine, and epidemiology to explore the health needs of people living in prisons relative to their own needs, that we should not be seeing differences like we do in terms of the health of people living in corrections facilities. And usually that work is really about focusing on how we can improve the health of the people living there. Right now, it's a little bit different. Improving the health and the social distancing of people who live in prisons is about our collective survival and well-being in the context of COVID-19.
Okay. So I've heard the term vectors, that prisons can become vectors for the distribution of this disease. And what I've been advised is that's for a couple of reasons. One, the ones you just pointed out, but also the fact that in many communities where prisons are located, they do not have robust or large healthcare systems. So the other issue is if we see a number of prisoners and staff who are diagnosed with COVID and worse still, require hospitalization, that just by having the institution have an outbreak, that could overwhelm the healthcare system very immediately. Is that what does vectors mean? Am I understanding that correctly?
You know, vectors is a troublesome term when we think about it for people, because we generally think of vectors in communicable disease epidemiology as the hosts of a condition that can then be transferred to people. And so we might want to be a little careful about using that term vectors for other people and other members of our community. But the concept is strong. A vector is a separate host that can have an infectious disease. And because we have trouble controlling that disease within that host, it is transferred to people. So the vector for malaria is mosquitoes.
Okay.
That's why we think of it as a vector-borne condition. COVID does not have a vector in that sense. It's in humans and it's transferred from human to human. But here's where the concept is really, really strong. What it is like kindling or tinder in a fire, in that if you have a really strong group of people who are going to get COVID, irrespective of how well they respond to it clinically, they might all get better, but they are going to get COVID in a really strong way, and they're going to be in a confined setting where they continue to brew to brew that COVID, transfer it from one person to another. And that group is not hermetically sealed from the rest of society. The idea that prisons are hermetically sealed is something of an absurdity. There are staff who have to work there. There are healthcare professionals who have to work there. There are food services and janitorial staff who work in prisons. This is not a hermetically sealed population. If the people living in prisons have COVID at an extremely high density, and there are people moving in and out of that facility, COVID will move out of that facility. It will get in and it will get out. And as a result, in those rural communities that you're talking about, or settings with more limited resources, the outbreaks of COVID that follow not only in the prisons, but in the surrounding communities from the fact that we have those centers will be much more difficult to control, much more difficult to manage. The analysis gets complicated when we think about prisons as a special setting, but it in some ways becomes much easier if we consider other environments where there are many hundreds or many thousands of people brought together. If for some reason I'm sitting in the city of Toronto right now, if for some reason one of the universities decided that irrespective of the orders against them, they were going to open and hold classes of a few thousand people right now, our whole community would be worried about it, because mm-hmm. there would be 1,000 people getting together for a biology 101 class. They would all be really a pretty good risk of transferring COVID to one another sitting in that auditorium. And then they would all go home. And we would all be worried that we're all going to get COVID because they held that biology 101 class. A prison is really no different to that. Mm. A prison in our community with people really tightly brought together with a few hundred or a few thousand people is exactly the same risk to our broader society as somebody violating those orders that we expect of any other part of civil society, mm. bringing a big group of people together, and then everyone's going to get an infection. And so in some ways, as an epidemiologist, I see the questions around the specificities of prisons as a distraction from the more clear epidemiological concern of gathering a few hundred people together. Mm-hmm. We are concerned about that in any environment, and prisons are no exception.
Right. Well, and some members of the public might say, but these individuals might be a danger to the public, not just because of COVID-19 and spreading it, but because of other issues. But it's interesting, over the past several weeks, I have been receiving a number of calls and messages from physicians and other healthcare professionals working in prisons, extremely concerned, not just about the crowding and the inability to do physical distancing, but the lack of appropriate hygiene and health resources available. If you were advising any correctional service, and I know there's been a patchwork of responses across the country from different provinces and territories, but if you were advising any correctional authority, if they came to you and said, as an epidemiologist, Dr. Orkin, what do you recommend we do right now? What advice would you be giving the correctional authorities?
I'd be saying that the single most important thing that we can do is to think about this problem first and foremost as one of, it's almost one of geometry. We want as much space and distance and then walls and then doors between people as possible. And so there are many ways that we can achieve that with the population in correctional facilities. First thing we can do is we can turn off the tap. So there are people being moved into correctional facilities, and we can make sure that that is brought to an absolute minimum, if not stopped entirely, so that the number of people isn't rising in correctional facilities. And I know that there have been people across the country working on that question in terms of bail hearings, in terms of sentencing proceedings and otherwise. Then there's the question of the people who are already in those correctional facilities. And again, this is about doors, walls, and geometry. We need to look at the number of people who are there and try to depopulate that as much as safely possible. I am not an expert in balancing the risk to society of COVID versus any individual prisoner or person experiencing imprisonment and their risk to society. That is for the courts and for other health officials who make that their area of expertise. But I do know from the available data that the number of people in correctional facilities in Canada who, especially under a circumstance where the rest of civil society is confined to our homes, that the number of people who are a meaningful risk to society is tremendously low, and the percentage is tremendously low. And so I would be advising to move as many people out of correctional facilities as humanly possible. And I would say there is no minimum threshold on this. Anyone who has a home to go to, where they can put more space between themselves and other people than they would in correctional facilities, should do that, and should be given the ability to do that. I would be aiming to use other spaces if necessary. So if there are people who must remain under with corrections facilities, but there's not enough space at corrections facilities, I would be looking at hotels and other spaces in order to expand the square footage, rooms, doors, and walls between people rather than having multiple people in groupings. Other concerns like sharing washrooms, sharing physical space, sharing telephones in order to make calls, sharing dining facilities are all a concern not only to the people who live in corrections facilities, but to the general public. And so we should be making efforts to distance as much as possible. But again, more than any of that, the most important move is depopulation, mm-hmm. Or decarceration, in that the best way to achieve that social distancing is just to have fewer people under management in a congregate setting. Mm-hmm. And that, from my perspective as a population medicine physician, has nothing to do with balancing the risk to society of any individual prisoner versus the risk of COVID. It is only a matter of the extraordinary risks that society faces right now due to this infectious condition. And on the specific cases where such a balancing is necessary, I would leave that to an expert in that field.
Okay. Now, my last question to you is, one of the things I was looking at this morning is the numbers from yesterday show that for every test of whether it's staff or prisoners that the Correctional Service of Canada at the federal level is doing, 20% are testing positive for COVID. Now, the testing isn't universal. What does that tell you about the incidence right now that is likely in the prisons, or does it tell us anything?
Well, this is a similar phenomenon across all of society right now. With testing, we only see the tip of the iceberg of how big the epidemic is. And that's because we don't test everybody. And I should add, it doesn't make sense to test everybody. There are lots of people with minimal or no symptoms. And conducting tests in all people who have no symptoms produces other sorts of testing problems. But we do know that if 20% of tests are coming back positive, that is far, far higher than what we would expect with broad testing. So it means with a very high degree of certainty that the number of tests that are actually, the number of cases that are actually present in that subpopulation in that community has got to be higher than the number that we are catching with those tests, almost by an order of magnitude. And so once we are detecting COVID with such limited testing in correctional facilities, the virus has effectively taken hold already in those correctional facilities.
So order of magnitude sounds pretty bad.
In order of magnitude, I mean like tenfold, probably somewhere around tenfold, would be my back of the envelope estimation. In other parts of the world where we have broad testing, we would expect well below 2% positive rates in a community where there is ongoing transmission. That's very high. 20% is very high indeed.
So 20% is of those who are testing. Corrections is saying less than 0.5% of those who are in custody have tested positive. Is it too late once there are outbreaks? Is it too late to reduce the numbers?
Absolutely not. This is a long game responding to COVID. And the need to reduce congregate living and enhance social distancing is crucial right through this epidemic. So we can map ourselves forward. Let's map ourselves forward many months. I don't know exactly how many months, but let's imagine we're now at the stage where we are actually demobilizing our response to COVID. The children are back in schools. You can have visitors at long-term care facilities again. I don't know how many months out that is, but it is out there somewhere, we all hope. If we don't have adequate social distancing in prisons or corrections facilities and we have ongoing transmission there, we are going to have just like the reverse of a fire that is started because it has a really strong tinder that started in the corrections facilities, and then the big logs burn and then it comes back down. The last embers to burn out are right at the center of the fire. We're going to have ongoing transmission in corrections and other congregate living settings after the big wave has ended in the general public. And as a result, those congregate living centers are going to be the spaces that cause what we call second and third waves, where it again moves out of those congregate living facilities into the general population again. And so we need to be attending to the congregate living facilities as the epicenter of how our population manages this epidemic at any stage of the epidemic. The more space we put between people who are packed in cheek to jowl anywhere in society, the better throughout this process. And that's for everyone's best interests, not just theirs. Now, on a separate level, I should say that we have plenty of data that says that people who live, especially those who live long-term in corrections facilities, have their own set of health problems and comorbidities. Their adjusted age, which is sometimes referred to, is at least 10 or 15 years higher than their stated age. And so what that means is that somebody who is 50 is more like somebody in corrections is more like somebody who is 60 or 65. And we know that that COVID really affects people based on their other health problems. So having respiratory problems, having cardiac problems, having diabetes, being an older adult is more dangerous for COVID. And so this does also have implications for the very people who live there, not just the general public. When COVID takes hold in corrections facilities, a disproportionate number of the individuals who live there will end up in hospital or dead in comparison with the general public. Anytime is a good time.
And we need to act now.
Anytime is a good time, and anytime is too late at this stage.
Robin Maynard is an activist, author of Policing Black Lives, State Violence in Canada from Slavery to the Present, PhD student, and Vanier Scholar at the University of Toronto. So, how are you doing? And how are you managing in these truly unsettling times?
I'm doing okay. I think, like all of us, it's been a difficult adjustment. Absolutely. Of course, you know, adjusting to the fact that there is a global pandemic, adjusting to the fact that many of the things that we took for granted in our day-to-day life are not going to return to normal, or perhaps they're, you know, we will definitely forge through with a new kind of normal. I think that what's happening right now is just also really exacerbating so many of the injustices that we see in our society more generally. So it's really alarming and distressing to see how many people are being left behind and left out of the COVID-19 response as well. So that's something that has been very jarring and very, I guess, motivating for me at this time when some of us, including myself, you know, are able to stay at home and self-isolate. It's really important at this time to make space in our lives to push for everybody to have access to that same, those same life-saving really measures.
So from what I understand, you were supportive of organizing for the four men who were detained at the Laval Immigration Holding Center and who ended up staying on a hunger strike to try to obtain the release and protect themselves from contracting the deadly coronavirus. I'm just wondering if you can say a bit more about the strike and what their demands were.
Absolutely. So I have been very active in supporting those that were on hunger strike, as well as pushing more broadly for the release of migrant detainees in terms of this, you know, grave and extremely dangerous public health crisis that we're facing. So I think that we need to remember that as Canadians, we're being urged to take social distance, to practice isolation as much as possible. Imagine having to go on hunger strike in order to have access to that, right? So on March 19th, already there was a handwritten petition. Now even think about what it would mean to organize that while in detention, signed by 34 people. That said, given the urgency of the propagation of the coronavirus, we believe we are at high risk of contamination. Here in the detention center, we are in a confined space. Every day we see the arrival of people, of migrants from everywhere who have no medical appointments, nor have they had any tests to determine whether they're potential carriers of the virus. There's the presence of security staff who are in contact with the external world every day and also have not had any testing. For these reasons, we're writing this petition to ask to be released, right? So that's a petition from people that were very much afraid for their own conditions, for their own safety. It's very clear on speaking to the detainees that they learned about the pandemic, not from the staff of the detention center, but from television, from the newspapers, right? Learning about this, this terrifying possibility. Possibly dying from a horrific virus that the world has never seen before, and learning about that just from television while sleeping in rooms where there are no windows in close proximity to one another. Many of those, you know, who initially took on the strike had asthma, had health issues, right? So we're looking at people that are extremely vulnerable, who just have not had any access to even the basic protection measures that we've seen, that Canadians are being asked to uphold, right? To protect ourselves and to protect other people. So after a week of inaction on the part of the government officials, no response, detainees launched an indefinite hunger strike to demand their release. They decided to go on indefinite hunger strike. They released a communique that said that their hunger strike would be done in the most peaceful way, that they were not breaking any detention center rules, right? That they really just felt that in order to protect themselves from the pandemic, it was crucial that, you know, that they took more steps. And those are steps that are, of course, of great personal risk to them. Like, if you imagine what it would be like to not eat for even one day, if you look at what that would mean to do 8 days, we see that it's an incredible testament to their courage. And of course, there is massive public support from medical practitioners, from human rights organizations all across the country, including from people behind bars. And in the end, the hunger strikers were quite fortunately released after an 8-day hunger strike.
So you mentioned and touched on the fact that many of the hunger strikers were risking their safety and potentially their lives because of the fact that they were striking. But I know that they're also at additional risk because they might be targeted or challenged by guards or threatened for going on this hunger strike and attracting maybe negative attention to the detention center. And, you know, initially, from what I understand, there was 30 detainees at the beginning of this hunger strike, but that number sort of dwindled and dropped to 4. So do you know why those numbers dropped so dramatically? And perhaps you can speak to some of the challenges and obstacles that the hunger strikers faced along the way.
Sure. So again, in addition to the, you know, the high risk that they were already facing of a COVID-19 outbreak, you know, at any possible time, right? Those that were on hunger strike. Now, some of them had been released, but many others were being threatened by CBSA, being told that they would be transferred to jails, being told that they would put in isolation. At some point, they were being mocked for drinking juice on their hunger strike, even though that's a very normal part of hunger strikes, because otherwise you can get to, you know, near immediate organ failure, right? But they were being mocked for drinking juice. At some point, the hunger strikers had guards following each of them around individually who were listening to their conversations. People were being told that they would be considered as having broken the rules and hence not able to be released, right? So the fact that even though they were very clear when they undertook the hunger strike that, you know, they were not eating to protest their conditions, their vulnerability to COVID, but they were not breaking any rules, they were nonetheless threatened for doing so.
Even though the 4 hunger strikers were released, that was obviously not the full extent of their demands. And there remains, I think it is 30 detainees from the last I checked, who are still stuck and detained and unable to secure safety outside of the jail.
Yeah, I think, important, the fact that there are people left behind. They had been pushing for the release of detainees. And something important that had also arisen from that was, of course, housing upon being released. We're hearing of detainees that would be released and then just be forced to sort of figure out public transit in a city that they don't know. And if we look at those that are remaining in that detention center, we also need to take into account the number of detainees that are still being held at provincial facilities, because of course in Canada, migrant detainees are both held in the migrant detention centers as well as being held in provincial jails. Yeah, this is something they've been criticized for by public health bodies for a long time now, but it's still a practice.
So I know that there's some folks who might be concerned that, okay, well, didn't this person commit some sort of violation of the Immigration Act? Is it going to be a threat to public safety if immigration detainees are released? What is the potential threat to public safety? What do you say to those folks who are concerned about that?
Well, what I think we need to remember is that carceral institutions, whether we're looking at jails or prison or migrant detention centers, themselves represent a threat to the public health in this problem. That's why, for example, you have the United Nations High Security Council, you have the European Council as well, pushing the WHO, pushing for the release of migrant detainees around the world because of the catastrophic health risks of people who are being detained. And I think a better question that we need to ask ourselves as a society is, what impact does caging people in unsafe conditions ripe with exposure risks have on the public safety? Are these people not also the public, right? When we had asylum seekers crossing the border from the United States into Canada, there was a celebrated notion that this was the new Underground Railroad. But now many of those people, including one of the migrant detainee spokespeople, Abdul, have ended up in detention, now being possibly exposed to the virus, possibly left to die in an unprecedented global health emergency. So if detention centers are already not keeping people safe in a general sense and are maintaining at this time, especially, a lack of safety for the migrants, I think it's more clear to say that releasing people, releasing prisoners, releasing migrant detainees is actually an immediate improvement of public safety if we include people that are more vulnerable in who we think of as the public, right? That we don't want, for example, not having citizenship to be something that leads to a possible death sentence. Stealing a car is something that leads to a possible death sentence. I also think that it's important to make a distinction, just to be clear, that people who are being held in immigration detention, it's technically not because of breaking, for example, an immigration offense. That's a common misunderstanding. It's actually what's considered administrative detention, right? So the vast majority of the nearly 9,000 people that were held in immigration detention in 2018, 2019 were there because they lacked proper identification or because they were considered a possible flight risk, which can even just mean that you have close family ties and wouldn't necessarily want to be deported. I want to make clear that I think that people that have been convicted of criminal offenses also need to be released at this time, that incarceration is just a kind of violence that doesn't address social issues and economic issues. So I'm not trying to say that migrants should be released because they're not criminals and that criminals shouldn't be released, for example, right? I think that in some ways is a way that leaves many people behind, especially often Black migrants, right, who are the ones that are the most targeted by the criminal injustice system. But I do think that we need to remember that, of course, yeah, detainees are technically not even being held for those reasons, and a very small fraction of those people are held for what are considered risks to the public security.
So for folks who are at home and maybe they really support this and they would like to see more detained migrants released, or all of them across the country, what is the strategy for folks to continue to advocate and to support this work?
Well, we're still urging people to call and email Bill Blair, people can urge their coworkers to do so. If you have a professional organization or a union, to do that, to share on social media, to write letters to the editor of your newspapers. If you're in another city outside of Montreal, find out there where migrants are being detained, whether in a provincial facility or a detention center. And if there are already solidarity actions being organized, for example, like the one in Surrey, BC that we just saw, join one. If not, you can start one. It's also really helpful at this time to donate to the Solidarity Fund, for example, that Solidarity Across Borders has been recently publicizing, because right now we know that detainees are not being offered anywhere, you know, any kind of safe and secure housing, right? So to put money towards actually helping us find places to house people who are being released, to actually reintegrate people safely into their communities.
I guess that's another one of my questions. So we know that there are limited beds available in halfway houses, and some folks don't have secure housing arranged upon their release. So what role does the state have to play in these situations, and what needs to be done to provide more options for safe housing for prisoners and detainees who are released?
One thing that I think we've seen with the response to the risks of COVID-19 is the fact that, you know, despite what's been considered an issue, for example, of homelessness across Canadian cities, that it was always a social and political choice not to address homelessness. That there's always been enough money, enough resources to house homeless people. There's always been enough space. It's not for lack of empty spaces in any given city, you know, filled with ghost hotels, right. Airbnb, that we haven't actually had the place, that we haven't actually had the funds to house people, right? So in Toronto, for example, we've seen an incredibly powerful push by community health workers, by outreach worker, by homeless people themselves to put people who aren't able to self-isolate because they don't have a home in hotel rooms. And we've seen, you know, some movement around that has been really important. So it makes us realize that, you know, something that's been treated as an unsolvable problem was actually always a political choice. Right. And again, it's choice in this instance to not house people. And in this time, it's also, you know, a public health risk not to do so in a time where in order to flatten the curve, we have, you know, the World Health Organization telling us that we need to release detainees. In order to flatten the curve, we know that we can't have people who don't have access to running water, to a place to sleep, to a place to be, that itself, you know, has always been a human rights catastrophe in and of itself, but at this time it's also a massive risk to public health and puts those people extremely at risk of the virus, of complications from the virus, and also increases the risk more generally to society at large.
So we know that the CBSA is slowly releasing migrant detainees through individual detention review hearings. And I'm wondering if you know what factors decision makers are weighing before either releasing detainees or sending them back to being detained. And I'm just wondering if you think that this one-by-one consideration strategy for release is effective.
So what we've heard is that they've been applying the vulnerability criteria that council have been making proposals for release. But, you know, much as, of course, you know, the mass public pressure, the hunger strike has helped to accelerate the release of detainees, you know, every day people are at increased risk of an outbreak, right? So every day that we don't release all detainees and find them secure housing, we're increasing the risk of an outbreak. So for example, there's already been a guard and now a former detainee that has tested positive from the Toronto Immigration Holding Center. We've now received confirmation after detainees had been speaking about this for the past few days. They'd heard rumors that a guard at the Laval Immigration Holding Center had tested positive for COVID-19. And now we know that that has been confirmed, mm-hmm. right? So every minute that we are not using towards just releasing detainees to making sure that they can also be safe, that they're also part of that public that deserves to be protected from the virus, we're exposing people to risk. And it's really important, I think, for all of us that we use this time when many of us are rethinking, you know, what it means, like what kind of society that we want to live in, what kind of future that we want to build, that we don't leave behind some members of our population when we're talking about how to protect all of us from COVID-19.
And finally, Louise Arbour is a Canadian lawyer, prosecutor, and jurist. She is currently the Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General for International Migration. Louise Arbour was the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, a former Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, and in 1995, Arbour was appointed as President of a Commission of Inquiry under the Inquiries Act for the purposes of investigating and reporting on events at the prison for women in Kingston, Ontario, following allegations by prisoners of abuse.
Good morning. I'm joined by the, I still want to call you Madam Justice. I still want to call you Chief Commissioner. I want to call you everything because of the amazing work you've done and continue to do. But I want to take this opportunity too to thank you for the way that you have humanized and created an understanding of the issues related to prisoners that I think is still the high water, not I think, I know is still the high water mark when I think of inquiries and investigations. 26 years ago, there were events at the Prison for Women. 24 years ago, you issued a groundbreaking report. And today we're talking about the impact of COVID-19 in the prisons. And the I was just speaking to an epidemiologist, Dr. Orkin, who studies epidemics. And he was just telling me something that I found quite horrifying, that the numbers that came out just within the last few days from corrections indicate that about 20%, 19 point something percent of the tests they're conducting of prisoners are coming back with positive results, in that people are testing positive for COVID-19. And although corrections is saying that less than half of a percent of the population of prisoners in their custody have tested positive, his indication was that those the results of those tests, he used the term, are should be recognized as being much higher than that by an order of magnitude, which he described of tenfold. He also said that even though the numbers are already growing in the prisons, and some of the response of individuals who are commenting about this is that the result now is that we should just lock down the prisons and keep people isolated so that it doesn't spill over into the communities, is actually incorrect, that as long as we are experiencing this pandemic, that any areas where the prisons or whether where closed communities are experiencing outbreaks, there should be ongoing efforts to reduce those numbers, to allow the physical space. He kept saying there needs to be space between people, there need to be doors, there need to be walls between individuals so that we stop the spread of this. Otherwise, we'll just see repeats of this. And he described it as embers in a fire, that it would just, it, you know, repeated flaring up of this pandemic could occur. That to me I found horrifying in the context of a correctional system that 24 years ago you recommended that we have judicial oversight and that there be ways in which prisoners who had experienced interference with the lawful sanction, the sentence they were that was meted out by whichever judge sentenced them, should have the ability to go back before courts. As we're sitting here today, physically distanced, you've seen many situations internationally, many crises. What would you hope Canada would be doing right now?
You know, these are very strange times. It's I find whichever way we look at this COVID-19 pandemic, it's full of paradoxes. And I think there's nothing more striking than when we look at the situation of people who are confined against their will. And on that, I think I would guard against making a lot of very false analogies between, you know, my isolation and the restrictions on my liberty and pretending that this is similar to solitary confinement. I think we have to be very careful not to fall into the kind of distress that some people feel at not being able to go out and see their friends. So we need to understand this very unique environment and the power that society exercises, in this case through the Correctional Service of Canada, over people. So when I talk about paradox, I mean, one that to me is very striking is that we think of prisoners as people who are dangerous to us. In this case, we are dangerous to them because the virus could have only penetrated a prison through the outside, either through correctional service employees or visitors. And so here they are, completely powerless to ensure their own safety. And I think when we impose a sentence, that could come to the question of judicial oversight. You know, I've said that from the beginning. The judge is responsible for determining the length of a sentence, but he or she is entitled in law to assume that this relatively long sentence or short or medium term will be applied in accordance with the law, including fundamental human rights principles and an observance of all the rules and regulations that, if you read them in a textbook, look pretty decent, but that in reality we know are very often not applied. So I think in this particular case, in the case of a health pandemic type issue, we always talk about, and there's general public consensus on that, we need to look after the most vulnerable. But when people think about vulnerability, they look at that through a lens of empathy. For instance, if you take different categories of vulnerable people, old people, we know today are eminently vulnerable, usually children, it could be people with disabilities. Recently in Quebec, there was this thing about pregnant women not being allowed to bring someone with them in a delivery room, a spouse or someone to support them. And there's always quite a bit of public sympathy and empathy and a willingness to push the government to be more attentive to these people. You don't hear a lot of that about prisoners. And yet, to me, the very concept of vulnerability goes to the question of, in a sense, popularity, if you could put it this way. The most extreme vulnerability is the vulnerability of people who have no friends, no friends in the political discourse or in the body politics, who have very little voice. And if they have a voice, it's very easily dismissed. I forget who's, the old saying that the quality of our democracy will always be judged by the way we treat the least popular people. So, and in this case, as I said, I think it's exacerbated by the fact that we, the external world, are creating the most dangerous threat to people who have zero way of protecting themselves because they have absolutely no control over their living conditions. So if there was ever a case to be made for revisiting the way we do business, taking extraordinary measures of protection, I think it's very much with respect to people who are detained. And of course, then there's everything you've talked about, their vulnerability, their physical vulnerability is increased by the fact that in close confinement, the spread, we've seen it certainly in the case of senior citizen facilities of all kinds, people who are in close contact with each other are very likely to continue to contaminate each other. It's true for correctional officers as well. I mean, again, talk about perceptions of vulnerability. There's a lot of public support for healthcare workers, but a lot of correctional officers are in the same situation. They have to provide services to a population and they live with them, not day and night, but in this closed, confined environment. So it's also on the service provider side that there are specific vulnerabilities that you never hear about. And it seems to me that's why advocating an impartial oversight mechanism, it's not going to emerge spontaneously from the inside of bureaucracies, this kind of change of paradigm and recognizing the need for special attention to these people. It has to come from external credible sources such as the judiciary. So it brings us back to, some things we talked about and that I recommended in this report, so 24 years ago, that has had no traction up to now, which is serious oversight over the conditions under which a sentence is served. And I think until we get there, we're going to have these concerns and very few ways of addressing them appropriately.
Mm-hmm. It's very concerning, I agree. And you're one of the few judges, or when you were a judge, who exercised the right to enter federal penitentiary. And as we know, judges, members of parliament, senators, have rights of access. And one of the things we've been trying to do, and really on the advice that you gave many years ago, I remember you saying something, and I apologize if I'm misstated or overly stated, but you indicated that anybody who's involved in this kind of work, whether it's police officers, prosecutors, judges, legislators, who are creating sentences, if you will, or who are part of administering the laws, have a responsibility to know what the conditions of confinement are within the sectors that they send people, or whether it's because they're, again, part of prosecuting or because of sentencing or because of creating those laws. From this, many people will say, well, you know, that's all very well and good, but, you know, you and I know who's in prison is often not the most privileged folks. Are there any other issues that you think coming out of this we should be concerned about or that we should be aware of that may actually give us hope that we'll see some changes going forward in the future? Whether it's about will we see changes in sentencing patterns, do you think? Will we see changes in strategies of decarceration? Are there things that make you hopeful coming out of this, or are there things that we should be particularly wary of in terms of ensuring that we don't slide into a much more restrictive setting?
Yeah, I think coming out of this COVID-19 pandemic, we're going to see, everybody seems to agree, that we're going to see possibly some pretty radical changes in lots and lots of things. What I worry about the environment of incarceration is that it's not likely to be any more a priority when we come out of this crisis than it's been in the past. Having said that, to the extent that they will be, I think, a kind of spirit of acceptance of pretty radical changes in lots of fields, this, if the right advocates are in place and if we stay on the issue, we may see actually some changes that would have seemed radical before the pandemic. For instance, if the government is looking at cutting costs and so on, you might see a movement towards less incarceration, not for the kind of reasons that criminologists would talk about, that it's not a form of punishment that's particularly effective, it has terrible collateral effects and so on, but just to save money. So we may actually see it, an opening of opportunity that may not be inspired by great sentiments, but that would actually move the system in the right direction. So on the one hand, I'm optimistic that there will be a mood for pretty radical opportunities for pretty substantial radical changes. On the other hand, this will not be a priority. The healthcare system will be the absolute priority. So if we could put some energy towards pushing for reforms, I think there will be opportunities that were not there before.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think of things like we've spoken at times about things like guaranteed income and some of the measures that are extraordinary economic measures that are being taken right now. One of the long-term benefits may be that we actually rebuild a more robust healthcare, but also a social safety net, healthcare system, but also a social safety net, which I can't help but think will actually prevent more people from being on the margins, from being victimized, from being criminalized, and could result in the increased improvement of our standard of living in a way that advocacy efforts before this have not necessarily achieved. And, you know, as I'm looking at some of the historical pieces, as you've done the international work, is that just Kim being, you know, typically optimistic and pie in the sky? Or do you think there's some likelihood that we'll see this, you know, more robust rebuilding of this very supports that too many people have literally fallen through the cracks, or they're, you know, we've remove the floorboards, or as Hugh Siegel has said, you know, we've told people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps when they don't even have boots.
Again, I think that there will be a mood for substantial change on a lot of issues. Like you, I tend to be optimistic that even though there will be pressures that will go very much in the wrong direction, such as, again, this kind of idea that we need to close borders and we need to gate communities, that protection comes from confinement to the smallest unit. That's, I think, very wrong-headed. It may be important in the short term to prevent the spread of a disease, but in the longer term, this idea of self-sufficiency, and, you know, we could all reduce each other to the smallest unit and then become self-sufficient, the end of globalization is absurd. It cannot happen. It should not happen. I think what we need to put in place globally and locally is a robust, equitable distribution of essential goods, and that includes ideas such as a guaranteed annual income. And I think an idea like that, that's been around for decades and rarely got any traction from political parties, is going to become very attractive when you see, first of all, how quickly the government can put in the hands of everybody enough money to survive, and not just for a couple of days, you know, presumably for a few months. Now, people do worry that at some point somebody's going to have to pay the bill for that. Mm-hmm. But I think there will be conversations about the savings that would come from transforming all these discrete pockets of social assistance and unemployment assistance and so on into a much more generalized system of providing everybody, you know, with the means to live adequately. And that in and of itself would probably in time reduce the strains on the healthcare system that always kicks in too late when mm-hmm. the costs are. So I really think these conversations will take place, maybe not in the very, very short, immediate term, because there'll be a lot of more immediate priorities, but the mood, I think, is being set for people to think very much outside the box.
If the Commissioner of Corrections or the Minister of Public Safety called you up and asked for your advice on what they should be doing right now, what would you tell them?
First of all, I would say, put all your information in the public domain. You know, you said earlier, and I felt very strongly about that, that people who work with the system should know about it. When I was appointed to the bench, you know, people told me all kinds of things that they thought were useful about what kind of robes you wear and where you purchase it and where you sit. But nobody told me that there was a provision in the Correctional Service Act that allowed judges to visit detention centers, prison or penitentiaries in the federal system on reasonable notice. And when I became the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, every time I did a country visit, every country I visited, more or less, I made a request if my visit was long enough to make a visit to a prison. And I understood reasonable notice to mean, how about this afternoon? Because mm-hmm. if you give 3 months notice, there's a lot of opportunity to repaint, let's put it this way. So I think, and I really believe, and certainly it has been my experience, that it's an eye-opener for a lot of people. You know, watching too much of Orange is the New Black, or even Unité 9, which I think mm-hmm. was a very good show, feeds into a kind of romanticized idea that of who prisoners are and in what circumstances they live and so on. So I think as much as I believe that officials who work in that field should have a hands-on knowledge of what they're dealing with, when judges, for instance, when they sentence somebody to prison, they should have a realistic idea of what it is they're doing. So I think I would say to the Correctional Service now, just as much as healthcare professionals are talking about the strains that this pandemic is putting on their environment, come out, tell us mm-hmm. what's happening in your environment. Is it business as usual? Is the union of correctional service employees, are they happy that their staff are adequately protected? Because their staff are the vector that brings the virus, for the most part, inside mm-hmm. the institution. So why don't we hear you know, from you, the same way we hear about healthcare professionals, about what the conditions are. I think this would be a major step forward if the issue had some visibility to start with. I think encourage a serious public debate about the fundamentals of the correctional system and of the duty of care that we have collectively, that we exercise through our government towards people that we have deprived of the means of ensuring their own safety.
That's great. And for those in the public who say we don't want more people out because we're afraid, any comments to them?
Well, you know, I think for professors, people who teach criminal law, constitutional law, international law, this will be matter for a lot of conversations. But, you know, I spoke to someone yesterday and I said, it's really interesting to me, if you look at this whole thing from a kind of human rights perspective, if you compare 9/11, okay, when these events occur, this was kind of grand scale terrorism. We said at the time the world will never be the same after these events. And sure enough, I mean, we saw a response to that in the eyes of some was worse than the acts themselves. And what 9/11 did is that it sent a signal that the world, essentially, our own communities, were divided into two: us, the good people, and them, the bad people, the terrorists. We didn't care too much about how the determination would be made as to who's who. We knew we are good and they are bad. And we were prepared even to make personal sacrifices, small ones, mind you, such as taking your shoes off when you have to go to an airport and travel, to protect ourselves against them. You know, there was this pandemic is not like that. We, every person on earth, certainly every person in this country, is at once a potential victim and a potential offender. Some are more afraid of being victimized, of catching the virus. Others are very concerned about contaminating others, their aged parents and so on. So for the first time, we're all in it together. We're all equally potentially victims and perpetrators. And I think that opens up the possibility for a conversation about, already you see people talk about, on the one hand, yeah, we need to penalize people who go to parks and have parties and don't respect the confinement, the social distancing policies. And then when they hear of fines of $6,000, they go, whoa, maybe that's a little over the top. These are all examples of conversations we'll be able to have, using that as principles for, you know, what is a real threat? What is the difference between people who may transgress laws as a result of a lot of circumstances that are not fully under their control, such as mental health conditions and social deprivation? I think also our natural empathy system has been boosted. So I think there'll be lots of opportunities to think of, in a very fundamental way, very differently about our criminal justice system. And as I said, in this particular case, as much as we may think of prisoners as being scary and a threat to us all, the reality today is we're more a threat to them, the outside world collectively. So, and I think people are receptive to thinking more seriously about so many things they've taken for granted. Now, nothing can be taken for granted. Our sense of space and time and so on is all distorted. So there's going to be an open-mindedness, I think, that's going to be very helpful to reforms in many respects, including prison reform.
So, Kim, I really learned a lot from the folks that we interviewed. And one concern that I know people have is whether or not releasing individuals from prison and investing resources into those people by, you know, placing them into hotels or providing folks healthcare outside of prison, whether or not that will be an additional strain on our healthcare system when we're concerned right now with the already incredible responsibility that we're placing on our healthcare professionals.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think that those are concerns people have and we should think about. And a number of people have contacted me and have said things like, why aren't we taking people out of seniors' homes and providing those opportunities? And I agree with that. I mean, we're seeing some of that now in Quebec, but there are hotels, Airbnbs, all kinds of resources, residential resources available that are not being used right now, that could be being utilized, that could allow us then to reduce the pull or the strain on the healthcare system by allowing everybody who needs to have access to the resources to physically distance, so that we can in the long term not have recurring incidences of this pandemic. Because as we're already seeing in China and places that where the first wave of this pandemic seemed to be have subsided, there's now a second wave coming. And there could be, you know, experts are saying, as Dr. Orkin did, that there could be second, third, and fourth waves of this. And so we need to be concerned about creating the space now. And for those individuals who are inside, who, for whatever reason, won't be released, if we can't distance them, then we're essentially saying that it's okay to leave them to die. And I agree, for any institution that's true, and it shouldn't be true for anybody in this country. And so one of the things we could be doing and should be doing, I think, is looking at reallocating resources at this time, and not just focusing on security issues or economic issues, but also talking about how we fundamentally look at interventions that will improve, will create safety right now, public safety, health safety, but will also look at recreating a safer, stronger, more robust, human rights-based social safety net and healthcare net. And so we need to be preparing and creating more equal access to the very life-saving measures that many of us have the privilege of experiencing now, but too many of us don't.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Appointed. Please link us, tweet to us, send us your comments, and until next time.